once more under the breach, dear friend.
Else close the wall up with our English dead.
And here we are, ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, with another exciting episode of The Personal Wealth Coach, starring Jeff and
Jake
McClure. Man, I say that so well.
You are very proud of the fact that we know how to say our names.
Yeah, but I can say all that stuff that went before in my radio voice.
I have noticed, and it's been pointed out to me by Neil and other people, that my radio voice and my robot voice are very similar.
Does that mean you're a robot, or your robot is a radio?
It means that the perfect voice for a robot as it comes, "Pardon me, sir, please step away from the corner." That's a radio voice, and it's a robot voice.
Really?
Yeah.
So, radio. Okay. Anyway, this is the Personal Wealth Coach. And we normally tell you at this point the telephone number to call, but if you call the telephone number, you're not going to get anything because the telephone system in here got fried.
By a lightning strike.
Or a Trump election.
Trump election, yes.
We're not sure which.
The lightning strike was part of the election.
Maybe that's why he won, because the lightning struck and it changed all the ballot boxes across the country.
It fixed the rigged system.
It rigged the fix system.
Could be.
Somebody put in a fix to the rigged system.
You notice that if you fix a rigged system, you put the fix in, which is another word for rigging?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but he definitely trumped.
He did.
Okay. Anyway, since we're starting a new hour, every hour is a new hour. I like that.
Yes, happy new hour.
I wake up in a new hour every hour. There's a litmus test, if you, like we do, actually care to remember something longer than the news cycle. If you want a test to see how well President-elect Trump, soon to be President Trump probably, supports the people who elected him.
Right. We're going to use a test to determine how acidic or alkaline something is. You said litmus test. So I'm just trying to.
Well, maybe it is.
It
could be that it's pretty acidic for him if he doesn't do this, but I don't think people remember that long. He made a big deal about a manufacturing plant in Indianapolis, Indiana, which, by the way, was one of the reasons he won Indiana, was he made the big deal about that specific plant. And it's a Carrier manufacturing plant where they manufacture air conditioners in Indianapolis, Indiana.
So this is an air conditioning carrier, not an aircraft carrier.
No,
they do craft air conditioners at a Carrier plant. Okay, Indiana.
This is Carrier. And the plan was that in 2017, Carrier is going to shut the plant down.
Uh-huh.
Lay off all the workers.
Uh-huh.
And they've been advertising this for 4 years now, and they've been training. They've been paying to have the workers trained, and there's lots of things that they've been doing. And it's going to they've already built the plant and got the equipment in it in Monterrey, Mexico, to do the same thing for a much, much lower cost, because the workers at the plant are earning about, on average, about $24 an hour.
Right. And the workers at the plant in Monterrey, Mexico, more like $6 an hour?
$24, no. Like $1.50 a day.
A day. Wow.
That's what it said in the article anyway.
Decent savings.
Well, you know, the fact is, particularly in light of the fact that the peso dropped like a rock, you can buy a lot of pesos for a dollar.
Yes, you can.
So one of the major promises that in Indiana that President-elect Trump made over and over again is, I am going to stop Carrier from shutting down this manufacturing plant. And it's actually United Technologies that he's got to stop, not Carrier. That's just a subdivision of United Technologies. And the workers there were interviewed by the New York Times after the election, and they said, he's either going to do it or he's not going to do it. If he's not going to do it, we're really going to be mad at him. And the people at United Technologies said, you must be kidding. As much money as we've invested in Monterrey, we're not going to shut the plant down. We have offered, basically they're offering a 4-year period after the shutdown during which they will both pay the workers, not full wages, but they'll pay the workers, and they'll offer them 4 years of free training in whatever technical area they want to get into. So the issue here is, I think United Technologies was probably doing the right thing. One of the key points in his election campaign is, we're going to bring jobs back to America. We're going to keep them from leaving America. This is going to be I think, a key test to see if he is capable of doing what he considered to be the cornerstone of what he was elected to do. And if he ignores this, and by the way, I'm just frankly a little confused as to how the President of the United States can tell a private enterprise of a publicly traded company, you can't shut that plant down.
Well, he said in his speech about the first 100 days that he's going to put tariffs on foreign countries for taking away jobs. Mm-hmm. If an American company lays off an American and then hires an immigrant or hires a foreign national in a separate country, that there will be a tariff against the American company.
He said during the campaign.
Of course, he can't do that without a act of Congress. But that's
but
one of the things.
He said in his campaign that if they move the plant, he would put a 35% tariff on any furnaces and air conditioners they imported from Mexico. And again, this is a very specific promise. It is a key to his election. It will be, to me, utterly fascinating to see if he makes even a serious effort. If he doesn't make a serious effort to do that, then I can say that the vast majority and maybe all that he said during the campaign, you can just write off and say, no, we can't, it's not going to happen. If he does that, and this is something that will happen in the very near future, he's got, during his first few months in office, he has to take action on this if he's going to affect it. And if he doesn't take action on it, and put a 35% tariff on, by the way, if he puts a 35% tariff on imports from Mexico, all the major automobile manufacturers in the United States will go out of business within 6 months.
This is one of the complicated things about free trade, is that it's very hard to target one industry, and it removes some of the power from government to target an individual industry. You have to target all industries. So can we hit his promises for the first 100 days? Because there's some really reasonable ones in there.
I want to hear them.
And there's some that just cannot happen, not because they're bad ideas or good ideas, just because it requires a lot of other people to do it. So first 100 days. First, constitutional amendment to impose term limits on members of Congress.
Can't happen.
It'd be nice to get term limits on people on Congress, but it takes a long time to get a constitutional amendment. I mean, you've got to ratify it with the two-thirds of the states, and you have to have a supermajority in the Senate to get it to pass. That means that the people who are going to be limited would have to agree in a huge mass, and there's not enough political capital.
I don't think you get the states to agree on it either.
I don't either. Okay, now I wish that would happen. So there's
in the first 100 days, you'll get a constitutional amendment.
Yeah, that's not going to happen.
No,
but
okay.
Second, a hiring freeze on all federal employees to reduce federal workforce through attrition, except military, public safety, and public health.
We tried that in Texas. Do you remember what happened when we tried that in Texas?
Well, there's another issue here in that he may have the power to do this.
Mm-hmm. He probably does.
This is an executive area. He has the power to say we're putting in a hiring freeze. The difficulty with that is that we'll start losing services.
Mm-hmm.
Because one of the problems with cutting the budget is you've got to find a place in the budget to cut that isn't going to hurt people. And that's why budgets haven't been cut so far. It's why Donald Trump hasn't proposed cutting budgets going forward.
That would fix Social Security, though. If the people in the Social Security Administration were retiring and they didn't get new ones hired, then it would be almost impossible to apply for Social Security.
It's already hard enough.
It would fix Medicare because you couldn't get a Medicare bill processed because there'd be nobody there to process
it. And
so that would solve the budgetary problem completely.
Here's a problem with this, in that the Republicans in the White House have cut funding for the IRS, which I think everybody listening to this program, including us, think, whoa, that's a really kind of cool idea. The IRS doesn't need to be too powerful. They overdo things when they're too powerful. The problem with it is I've got clients that come to me that said they did their tax return in April and they still have not received their refund.
That's because they cut funding to the IRS.
It's exactly. It's something that the IRS, somebody needed at the IRS to put eyes on that return and certified that that was appropriate as a refund, because it was a rather large refund for a rather large payment to the IRS.
I still think the hiring freeze, and I don't remember which governor of Texas put the hiring freeze on. It was well before Bush.
Then it Ann Richards or before
no,
that?
It was the guy. It was the one before Ann Richards, and I can't remember who it was.
This is ancient history.
Yeah, but still, we tried this at a state level, which is a lot easier than at a federal level. And the governor got a letter from the guy who operated the Aransas Pass drawbridge. You know, it's a bridge that goes up or down. And he says, okay, I'm going to retire next month. Do you want me to leave the bridge up or down?
There are problems there. So, okay, number three. Third, a requirement that for every new federal regulation, two existing regulations must be eliminated, which is a really cool one in, two out idea, but here's a major problem with it. Regulations are not counted like laws are counted. Regulations are brought on board with a whole series of things. There's subchapters of regulations. Which part of it is the regulation? How do you count two for every one? How do you do that?
Here's the issue with that from the executive perspective. Regulations are actually, they're not regulations, they're rules.
Right.
Are written by agencies within the federal government, within the executive branch.
To follow laws.
Because the laws passed by Congress and signed by the president require them to be written. Now, sometimes it takes them 16 years to write the rules for a law that's been passed, and meanwhile we've been guessing the whole time.
Right. Well,
have to repeal the law, which isn't going to happen because the Senate won't allow it.
Yeah, here's a good example of that. The tax code is the regulation that's the amalgamation of the thousands of tax laws. So there are a lot of regulations in there, and one of them, for instance, is this is the form required to file for these series of laws. How do you quantify removal? This is where the practicality gets in the way of a really cool idea.
Actually, the entire Internal Revenue Code now is a result of one law. It's the Tax Reform Act of 1986. And if you're going to remove regulations from the IRS, you'd have to do what Ronald Reagan and the Congress did at the time, which is completely rewrite the tax code. Now, that would be interesting. It'd keep them busy for several years.
This is outside of the first 100 days, but getting started on that simplification of the tax code is the beginning. What we're saying is that even the promises made right at the end of the election, and we've only gotten to the third one. Fourth would be a 5-year ban on White House and congressional officials becoming lobbyists. Well, that's not something he's allowed to do. That's a congressional issue. The president can't say you're not allowed to go get a job. That would be a dictatorship. So what we're saying here is that it's a great idea, and I agree with it. I don't think that a 5-year ban on White House and congressional officials becoming lobbyists after leave government is a bad idea at all. That's a really great idea. But how do you do it? You need a law in place. The president doesn't have a magic wand. He doesn't have the ability to step out and say to a private corporation, you are not allowed to hire this private citizen. So this tells you that even the ideas that I think most of America can agree on require going through a process to get there. And to do that in the first 100 days, try first 100 years, because limiting the who has to pass that law? You know right off who has to pass a law that would limit the ability for people leaving the White House or Congress to get a job with a lobbying firm. Congress has to pass the law. It's the same folks that would have to pass the law limiting the terms of office for congressional folks. Are they going to do it? Probably not.
Well, I read a survey a little while back of members, when I say a survey, a review of the number of members of the House of Representatives who in their initial run for the House fully supported and claimed they would vote for term limits. And it is an overwhelming majority of the members of the House of Representatives. And you notice they don't have term limits. Can I change the subject a little bit?
Yeah, let's do it.
Okay. I want to explain something, and probably many of the people who are, if anyone is listening, voted for Donald Trump, but did so maybe in a protest vote. I don't know. But to me, the clearest indication comes out of this New York Times article where they interviewed the people at the Carrier plant in Indianapolis. There's a team leader at the Carrier plant who they interviewed who is making about $24 an hour working at the Carrier plant. He gets a little overtime, so he makes about $55,000 a year.
So we're back to that. Mm-hmm. We haven't changed it. Okay, we're back to that subject.
But yeah. I wanted to point out something that is in the article that is more than just this Carrier plant. He is deeply concerned, even though he gets training, what he's going to do next, because there are plenty of job openings in the Indianapolis area. Unemployment is low. There are jobs going unfilled at the warehouse distribution centers for Walmart and a lot of other places.
It's just not at $24 an hour.
They pay $13 to $15 an hour, which is equivalent of about half of what he is making now. And he said, in order to make the same income I'm making at the Carrier plant now, I would have to work two shifts. I'd have to work 16 hours a day. And he's right. And the bottom line to it is people in manufacturing jobs who do things that can be done either by robots or less expensively somewhere else, because it's brainless. I hate to say this, brainless, but it is work.
It isn't brainless. It's
repetitive.
It's repetitive, and in some cases, this is where people are missing out on the robotic revolution. It's sometimes complicated choice making. People think this will never be replaced because you got to choose. If you think if you're on an industrial line, and you've got to find one item in a group of a lot of items going by that's defective. Well, robots can do that now, and they can do it better than humans can. That was a really highly skilled job. It's something you need to be able to identify at fast motion, a product that's defective, and remove it from the line quickly before it goes into the next stage of production. And robots do it a lot faster than humans do, but it's one of those areas that it's a skilled job. It's not a repetitive dummy job. It's a repetitive, extremely skilled, extremely difficult job that's being replaced mm-hmm. by robots.
And I've often said, no matter what the rhetoric is, we can't bring manufacturing jobs back to the United States.
No, we're producing more from the manufacturing sector of the economy right now than we ever have in the past. And we have about one-tenth the jobs mm-hmm. that we did at the top of the job production in manufacturing.
And many of the people who were running for political office in the 1920s and 30s ran on the basis of bringing the farm workers' jobs back.
Or, I mean, we've got a good song you could start saying. I'm not going to sing it, but John Henry was a steel-driving man.
Mm-hmm.
This is the same struggle. If you can take a scythe and go out in a field and harvest faster than a non-manned combine whose arms reach out to either side 100 feet in either direction, you cannot scythe that field faster. You cannot compete with the machine anymore. And that's the thing that throughout populist revolutions, whether it's Bernie Sanders, Donald Trump, you can go back to Andrew Jackson, new technology replaces jobs, and when they replace those jobs, it doesn't come back. When jobs get shifted overseas, and we have said this for decades on the air, when we outsource jobs, they never come back.
And they typically disappear overseas.
Right. I mean, if we think about something as simple as VCRs, you know, there was a big deal in my childhood that there were no people, no American companies produced VCRs anymore.
Now you might want to tell people what VCRs are.
It was a video cassette recorder. It was the old rewind before return. It was, you know, most of our listeners know what this is, but some of them don't. What is that? Is that like an 8-track? It's something like an 8-track. It's only it had video media on it. And it was a very upsetting thing when the last American television manufacturer took its jobs overseas. The last American VCR manufacturer closed down its shops.
It was Curtis Mathis on the television.
And we were really upset that the Japanese were producing VCRs, and it was an American invention, and we weren't making them anymore. Well, it went overseas, and then new technology came in. Another American invention came in, and it was the DVD, and then the DVR. And now people don't use either of those because it's easier not to have it recorded on your device. You just go online and click a button, and you don't even have to waste your own storage space. That's where jobs go in manufacturing as well. If you look at Tesla's car manufacturing facility, they didn't start with lots of workers. They started with lots of robots, and they've lowered the number of workers in the process, even at their own plants.
You know, person can make the argument the air conditioners are not good. We're going to need air conditioners in the future. But here's what has happened with workers in China, for example. First in India and then in China. Is initially a lot of people moved their labor intensive manufacturing or something to China. And what we're seeing is as the standard of living rises in China and the people who are educated enough to do the electronics manufacturing starts to go up. I mean, there's fewer people, so the wages start to go up, which is what's going on right now. What we're actually seeing is a lot of that manufacturing, not a lot, but a significant amount of that manufacturing is coming back to the United States now, but they're only hiring people who understand how to program
robots.
And then maintain the robots, which is not very many people, because those same circuit boards that are being hand welded in China right now, within a few years, will be robot welded in the United States.
And there's another piece of this. In the United States, our education level has come up over the years. The common person you see has at least a high school education. There are people that don't have that, but they are a small minority now. There were places that people could work when I was a teenager in high school that were a place that you could get a relatively okay wage. It was minimum wage, but it was really nice for a high schooler. You could go to work at McDonald's or at Burger King or at Taco Bell, and they're still hiring. But minimum wage is going up. And the places where they've mandated that the minimum wage go up to $15 an hour, there have been a lot of layoffs. This should not be shocking to anyone, because to keep the price point of that food that you want to get in a convenient situation, you want to stop and grab that burger or that burrito or whatever it is, you don't want to pay $15 for a burrito, unless it's a really, really nice burrito.
Now, some people will.
Right, but the majority of us look at that and say, no, I don't want to buy it. It's on the dollar menu. I'm not going to pay $15 for a dollar menu item. So a lot of the fast food restaurants are going to the kiosk concept, where you walk in, you hit some buttons on a screen, you pay with a card, and a machine gives you your food. The next step is already happening. There's apps out there that will be applied directly to the computers, and this is going to happen even where labor prices aren't going up. If you're on the road, you pull out your phone and say, I'm going to be over there in about 15 minutes. Let's go ahead and order some food. You hit the buttons. You pull through the drive-through. You've got your number already. It scans your phone and gives you the food. You've already paid for it, and you drive on.
Now, wait a minute. Does that mean the person is texting while they're driving? We need to have the Uber driverless car first.
It's happening. So the concept is that the car may order it for you. Say, hey, we're going to be going through Dallas-Fort Worth, find a place to get some burgers and pay for it. That's going to be the future. Well, there's a lot of jobs that get lost there, just like there were jobs that were lost on the farms when the tractor came along. We either have to find new jobs that didn't exist before, or at some point we're all indolent and the computers do the work for us. I tend to think that for a while we're going to find new jobs and better ways of doing it. At some point, that may be not the case, but that's hopefully further in the future.
Well, we have a major technological shift going on, and we started off early in the last hour with the discussion about the Uber truck, 18-wheeler, self-driving truck. Now, it had a person in the truck.
It was a Google, not Uber, but that's okay. It was a combination of Uber and Google.
Okay, well,
Google's software and Uber's mechanical interface.
Yeah, well, anyway, the company that actually owns the truck was owned by Uber.
Yes.
And the fact that happened, the description in there, by the way, I think was very revealing. Basically, the truck drives on the open highway, and as it arrives in a town, it turns, it pulls into a depot, and an actual driver takes it to the place where it's going to be unloaded, because the issue of jaywalkers and things like that and driving inside a city.
Right.
And I think that's probably the future, and I think we'll probably see, but this is what's driving that. It cost about $30,000 to convert this 18-wheeler, which is not very much.
That's maybe a quarter of what gets paid to a driver if they drive a lot.
So here's the point.
For a year.
Why would companies be in it now? Uber's not doing this because they think it's a great vision for the future, and they're not. The purpose in this was, and you see this on the back of trucks, there's a shortage of workers. There's a shortage of people who are willing to drive trucks.
Right, and this is something we know, truck drivers. The average age of truck drivers is not 20.
Really?
It's not 30. It's not 40. The average age of your traditional truck driver is 55.
Yep. And they're not going to be around a lot longer.
No. New drivers happen.
And you're not.
But they're rare.
You're not going to convince younger people that you need to take a week and drive a truck all week and then maybe come home on the weekends. And we'll pay you a fair but not exceptional wage for that when they can go in an air-conditioned office and make more money. So ultimately what is driving this is not some political movement. It isn't some conceptual movement.
It isn't foreign countries. It isn't a lot of the things that we can demagogue about.
We don't have enough people in the United States, particularly younger people entering the workforce, to grow our economy at the kind of rates that we saw in the last century, in the 1990s, for example, when we were getting 3.3 to 5% growth in the economy each year. We're one of the big reasons we're at 1 to 2% growth is the people who are exiting the workforce and retiring are about equal to the number of people that are coming on board who are younger and entering the workforce. So we have to do two things in the United States, and I think this is critical. And I'm, believe it or not, optimistic. One is we have to increase productivity. Well, that's happening with robotics. It's going to take a little while, but I think we're on the right track. The second thing is, and this is an opportunity for Congress and the president, when they decide to revamp immigration, which hopefully they'll do completely, set it up so that more legal entrants can come in and join the workforce, because if we don't get a lot of young people coming in from outside the country to join the workforce, we easily could slip into stagflation because we simply don't have enough workers and it isn't competitive to pay the people who are there a lot of money.
This is another one where you can look at Japan. You can see Japan has an aging population, much quicker aging population than we have. And they have been stuck since early 2000 and a bit before that time period in the same economic cycle of no growth. Their productivity has been flat. Their earnings have been flat. Everything, when you is on a macro level, Japan has not moved forward. Abe, when he became prime minister, pushed for these big things and had this quick little boost. But there's a demographic issue that can't be ignored, and you can't politically change people's age. Maybe at some point in the future, medical science can change people's age, but you can't do it by vote. I wish you could, but you can't.
The Wall Street Journal had a very succinct little comment in its article about this, It said, in order to make America great again, by the definition that President-elect Trump has been using, in order to make America great again, we'd have to make America young again.
And we can do that with robotics, we can do that with immigration, or we can do that by having a lot more babies than we are. And that's hard to convince people to do.
Telling a bunch of people who are in their 50s to have a bunch more babies probably is counterproductive.
Well, you could have, I think the 50-year-olds are telling the younger generation, go out and have babies, and the younger generations are going, why? Why
yeah.
should I? I mean, I like babies, but do I want to take care of 8 of them? No, I don't want to take care of 8 of them. And it wasn't that many generations ago that the average number of kids per family mm-hmm. in the United States was 6.
Well, there's a really good reason for that, and you can blame the Democrats, okay?
I could blame the Democrats anyway. Well, I could blame the Republicans anyway.
No,
I'm
going
to blame everybody anyway.
We'll just blame the Democrats for a minute. Franklin Delano Roosevelt. Prior to the introduction of Social Security and retirement programs, your children were your retirement program. And so by having 8 children, first off, that would give you a pretty good chance that 4 of them would live to adulthood.
Right, and then those 4 would take care of you
right.
later in life.
But the problem, and so actually having children was a net gain to a couple. The more children they have, and they would have them working on the farm, and then later on they would have them...
Yeah, it's free labor.
Taking care of the parents as the parents got older, it made a very, very good economic – it made good economic sense to have children. Today
– it's expensive.
It's about $1 million per kid. If you're going to put the kid into higher education and where the kid can actually get and keep a good job, it costs about $1 million per child to have a child.
Unless you get good scholarships, there's a lot of things that could happen to make that easier. But if you think about the concept of having a child today, children tend to move away from their parents. This is what we see these days.
Oh, they're trying to avoid that here.
I mean, I'm not moving away. I'm still right across the room from my dad. But,
but I know you're further away than you used to be.
That's a tendency. And the tendency is that as productivity goes up, as the opportunity mm-hmm. for better employment comes up, as education goes up, you go to the place. Now, we may see a reversal of that with better methods of virtual working. But the reality is that as long as the government is there to help take care of the older generation, the younger generation doesn't have to because they feel like they're already paying into the Social Security system. They're paying for the Medicare and not just for their parents but for everybody.
And this is one of those fundamental economic issues, which is why, for example – in Europe, in the developed countries in Europe, the birth rate has fallen off to the point where, for instance, in Italy, the average family has less than 1 child on average. In other words, it's not just 1 child per couple on average. We have about we're having actually about 1.7, 1.8 children per couple on average. In Italy, they're having 0.7, which means that the Italians will go extinct at some point in the not-too-far-distant future.
And we've got commercials to play, ending before the commercial break on extinct Italians is a pretty good way of going, I think. Shall we?
We make more pizza than they do now anyway.
Yeah. All right. So we'll be back after the break. If you want to call in, you can't. I wish you could, but you can't. Next week, maybe you can call in, and then we'll talk to you. So until after the break, this is the Personal Wealth Coach.
So you see.
And we're back with more of the Personal Wealth Coach, starring Jeff and
Jake
McClure. And we haven't heard anything. Lynn Willie has not called in a long time.
He has. You just not since you've been back.
Okay. What does he say when he calls in?
He says hello usually. And talks to me about specific things that I've just said.
And I really like to hear, I actually like to hear from Lynn Woolley. Lynn Woolley is a conservative who was pretty much anti-Trump. And one of the things I see coming in Congress, and it's going to be fascinating for me to watch, and I think I know how it's going to play out, is the conservatives have taken positions historically that have gotten them reelected on the budget and on debts and on deficits and things like that, that are almost completely contrary to what President-elect Trump won the election over.
There's some good Republican stuff in his first 100
sure.
days. He's got that pretty well
but I mean,
stated.
Specifically in the area of – but he's not a conservative.
No,
and I
not
think,
a conservative.
Very frankly, I think we're going to see – and I may be wrong, but you can take notes and say Jeff was right or Jeff was wrong. Call us in when
you
the phone starts.
You really don't have to take notes. You can just say Jeff was right or Jeff was wrong if you want. You
okay,
can say that about
but,
me too.
But it's worth – I'd be willing to admit I'm wrong. Somebody check me on this in the future. If – it plays out the way I think it's going to play out. There's going to be a three-way contest going in our federal government. You have a populist president who wants to spend a lot of money and run up some big deficits, and he said deficits are good and you can always renegotiate the debt, which I think is a fascinating idea.
That's another congressional. That's another constitutional amendment because it's pretty clear we've got to pay those debts.
But the debt to the Social Security and Medicare is what he might have been talking about, the ones he said he wasn't going to cut.
Right.
But,
those are things that we definitely could.
But this is the point. You've got one guy who says, I want to run the deficit up.
Uh-huh.
You've got members of Congress who run for office saying, we're going to keep the deficit down.
Right.
And then you got the Democrats.
Yeah.
And I think what will happen, frankly, is on a lot of items, you're going to have the White House and the conservative members of Congress opposing each other, and the Democrats have the swing vote.
Yeah.
That will be absolutely... which, in other words, we may actually get bipartisan activity in Congress.
What this looks like is that we have two parties in Congress and a third party in the White House.
That's probably very accurate.
And this is something that happens in history. We talked about this and spent a lot of time talking about how this is how the party structures change. That this is how the Whig Party came about. This is how the Federalist Party disappeared. It's how the Democrats became a party. It's how the Republicans became a party. When a member of the public who maybe was a politician before or was not a politician before comes forward with a populist movement that says a lot of things need to change, they generally run the first time on a party ticket. And the second time on their own ticket, you look at Jackson, you look at Lincoln, you just go back through the list, they were really good friends with the folks around them until they realized the folks around them didn't support them on a lot of major issues. And then they said, all right, well, I've got enough support in the populace to form my own party. And sometimes they do, and sometimes you get a Green Party, which is... I shouldn't talk badly about them because they believe strongly in what they do. They just don't have an impact anytime.
And I think they're going to have an impact. I'll use the word. I think it's low probability that their future impact will be large. How do you like that?
There you go. I mean, it may be possible that if we get a really populist movement that says that we need to put a lot of pollution in the air and it causes a lot of people to look around and say, hey, pollution's getting worse, not better. Then we might see a Green Party movement, but I don't think that's going to happen.
But this is the way our Constitution works and our laws work in this country. We have a Clean Air Act, and it would take an act of Congress and a signature of the president to repeal it, and it would be so overwhelmingly unpopular when the results spewed out. I don't think it's going to happen.
I don't either.
And I don't, what you don't see Congress doing, and I've never seen Congress do it, is repeal laws.
I've seen it happen. It's just vague in my memory. I'm trying to think of
even,
when it happened.
I can't think. For instance,
we don't get rid of old laws.
There's a
we
whole series of laws,
new ones.
Even in Texas, which has a much more nimble legislative branch than the federal government does. We have a host of laws on the books that have been invalidated by the Supreme Court. They're no longer in effect, but they stay the law in the state of Texas. You can still be arrested for violating them. It's well, just your defense is...
It's been a while, but Prohibition was repealed.
Prohibition was repealed. That was a constitutional amendment.
Yeah, that was a big law.
But I don't think...
The Fugitive Slave Act...
Yeah, but it's been like...
This has been a long time.
No, but Congress...
The Food and Fuel Control Act of August 10th, 1917...
Well, yeah, there were certain in the distant past there were certain restrictive laws that have been repealed, but in my lifetime in Congress there have been very, very few laws that were repealed.
Here's one. You'll remember this one. 1973, Congress passed the War Powers Resolution, and that replaced the 1964 Tonkin Gulf Resolution.
But that's not a law. That's just a resolution.
Resolution. That's it. So repeals don't happen very often. Congress is not geared in that direction. They don't like to remove old laws. They would rather just dismantle them and rebuild them in better ways
for their ideas. And as a result, you have laws on the books that contradict each other.
Yes, quite a few of them.
And that's why lawyers have jobs.
That's something that would be a great concept moving forward. If you're going to remove regulation, let's look at a bunch of laws that don't do anything anymore and get rid of them.
You could... For instance, one of the rules that President-elect Bush promised to repeal.
Bush?
No, sorry.
So is it Freudian
Trump,
slip here?
Trump promised to repeal was the Department of Labor's fiduciary rule. Well, the problem with repealing the fiduciary rule is that in 2006, a law was passed with Republican support. Heavy Republican support called the Pension Protection Act of 2006. That's the way it's real easy to remember what year it was passed. It moved the IRA's regulation and control to the Department of Labor and placed it under the Employment Retirement Income Security Act of 1974. And so it mandated that at some point the Department of Labor would have to do what it did with the fiduciary rule. No problem. All they have to do is repeal a law that was passed in 2006.
But that doesn't happen.
But they're not
going to
do it. They're not going to do it.
Really, what we're saying here is that as much change is likely to happen, the core of our system doesn't change with the president. It's the same thing we've been saying for decades again. The president gets the blame or the credit for the economy and very little control of the economy. They just get the blame or the credit. Bill Clinton did not balance the budget. He had a surplus during his administration, but he didn't write any of those laws, nor did he vote on any of those laws. That was a congressional thing. George W. Bush or Barack Obama, they were not responsible for the deficits that they ran. They were responsible for some of the things that caused the deficits. By saying going to war, we got a lot of spending, and Congress said, well, I don't want to spend that on our normal budget. We're going to put it over to the side, and we'll do it this way. But that's, again, a congressional act. The purse strings belong to Congress. The leadership and inspiration belongs to the president. And if our new president-elect can inspire us and can get some of this stuff to make us feel better about business, even if the things that he's proposing don't work, that inspiration will. That's what the president is really good for.
Let me kind of sum up, as we reach the end of the second hour, I'd like to kind of sum up some of the things that at least I think will change. We have been trying to recover from the Great Recession of 2008 and 2009 through monetary policy, which is what the Federal Reserve does. While the various heads of the Federal Reserve during that period have said again and again and again, we need fiscal changes. We need the government to step up, borrow some money, and spend some money to kick us out of the rut. I think that's going to happen. I also think the 30-year, and this is something I'm quite confident of, the 30-year bull market in bonds is over. We're going to see the bond values falling. We're going to see interest rates rising. How high they'll rise, I don't think they'll go anywhere near as high as they have in the past, but I think we're going to see rising interest rates, which, by the way, I think is a big plus because as interest rates start up this spring, now we'll just have to watch and see what happens, there will be a rush to buy houses because people have been putting off buying houses waiting for lower interest rates.
Now, I mentioned at the beginning of the first hour about the foreclosure rate spiking in October. It sounds like I just changed the subject. It's the same subject. The foreclosure rate is highest among people who bought their house between the years 2004 through 2007. It's the same issue that we're still trying to get rid of. This is still the Great Recession. This is the last pieces of it, the ones that went and bought the houses that they really couldn't afford, but they made it this far. Some of them, and you'll notice this, some of them had an adjustable rate mortgage that was set out for 10 years. And now they can't afford it anymore. Some of them had an interest-only loan that was set out for 10 years. And we talked about this 5 years ago, that we were going to see another spike in about 5 years. This is what we're seeing. It's been 10 years. Can you? This is really weird to say. 10 years ago is when the recession really started getting going. 10 years. How is that even possible?
It is. The other thing I think we're going to see, whenever, and this is very, very consistent in the 20th century, when you get a Republican elected as president and the Republicans control both houses of Congress, you see a stock market boom. You see a bull market kick in. Here's the question. And by the way, financial stocks will lead this because he's going to
regulatory reform is a big deal.
But here's the thing that it's probably a good idea to remember something. Those have ended badly. And let's just hope that somebody in, whether it's Newt Gingrich or somebody else, has done their homework and read their history and realized that stimulation of the economy by borrowing money, and it's a good thing at this point, I think, stimulation of the economy by borrowing money, restricting regulation, pumping in there, is like you said, it's kind of like a sugar high.
It's a good.
You got to follow up by changing policy again, but I think we're liable to get addicted to it. That's what I'm concerned about.
When I had malaria, it's been a long time, but it was back in 2008, I had malaria. When I came out of malaria, I had lost 30 pounds, and I don't really have 30 pounds to lose. And as I was coming out, they put me on steroids to get my appetite back. It's a really good idea if you're weak. I didn't have malaria anymore, so people would say I was recovered. My physical self was not recovered. So they gave me a stimulus of steroids, which in that environment was absolutely appropriate, and maybe even longer into a period so that I could gain back more than I had before I got sick. But if I were still on steroids, it would be horrible for me. Steroids are very similar to the kind of stimulus that we're talking about here. And the long-term use of steroids weakens the body. It causes the lifespan to get shortened. It's very, very clear. The material's all out there. And you can apply that analogy, and it fits word for word with the economy. If it's too easy to get into business, people get into business not to make a profit anymore, but because it's so easy to get in there. I mean, solar is a good example of that. When the surpluses are coming, not because you're making a profit, but because the government's paying you, it's not a good business. And we're about out of time for this week.
So we'll talk more about this next week, and hopefully you'll be able to call in. But if you would like to talk to us or talk to and leave messages for us to get us to talk about something next week, you can give us a telephone call locally. We have at the Personal Wealth Coach telephone numbers, and they're voicemail during the weekend and real live people during the week, and it is local 947-1111.
You can reach that same voicemail now or live people later, toll-free at 1-800-914-7526. That's 800-914-PLAN. You can go to our webpage, thepersonalwealthcoach.com or tpwc.com, where you can listen to podcasts unless you have already lost your sanity. If you need more sanity loss, you could go there. Until next week, this has been The Personal Wealth Coach.
Radio 1400 KTEM. Serving Central Texas, KTEM AM. Temple, Belton, Killeen, Fort Hood.
Fox News Radio, I'm Joe Chiro. Another